Let's open our Bibles and resume our study in John chapter number 2. And you remember that Jesus has spent the last few days down in the south end of the Jordan Valley, in the area where John the Immerser is still doing all of his ministry, collecting his very first apostles, first disciples that will become his apostles. And we can name them off, I believe. There was Andrew and Peter, his brother, James and John, who happened to be cousins of Jesus, the sons of Jesus' aunt Salome, the sister of Mary. James and John are Peter and Andrew's business partners in the fishing business there on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. So these four guys together had spent who knows how long away from their jobs down in the South Jordan of being disciples of John the Immerser. And so now they will return to Galilee as disciples of Jesus of Nazareth. Then we have Philip, who was from the same town in Galilee as Peter and Andrew, that is Bethsaida, Galilee, which is just about a mile and a half west of Capernaum. I think it's possible he also might have been a fisherman. And then he goes out and convinces his friend Nathanael Bartholomew to be a follower of Jesus. And this man is actually from the city of Cana, right next door to Nazareth. And even though he kind of poo-poos the idea of the Messiah coming from Nazareth at first, Jesus immediately impresses him by simply saying, "Well, before Philip called you underneath that fig or that fig tree, I saw you." And so somehow that was all it took for him to now suddenly believe, "You are the Messiah. You are the Son of God." And so it's possible that Nathanael was also a fisherman, and that was kind of the connection between these six guys that brought them together down to be followers of John the Immerser. But now they are ready to leave and go back north. So chapter 2 of the Gospel of John says, on the third day. Now the way that counts is, the last event was the calling of Philip and Nathanael. So that would be day one of the sequence, the day they pretty much left to head north to Galilee. Well, it takes a good 2 days' travel from the south end of the Jordan Valley to the north end of the Jordan River Valley near the southern end of the Sea of Galilee. It's about 60 miles. So 30 miles a day, a good walking pace, take you 2 days. And so the part of the third day is what you would need to then travel up to Cana. Because Cana is, as I said, about 3 miles north and a little bit east of Nazareth. They're in the heart of Lower Galilee in the hill area. So they all go together to Cana in Galilee, Jesus plus six other guys. The mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. Now, I have heard commentators to say that they were invited on the spur of the moment. I don't believe that one tiny bit. I believe that Jesus and these other guys had already been invited. At least part of them had already been invited. Jesus, most certainly. And this is not gospel here, but this is my guess based on some of the events that happen here. I believe this wedding was probably the wedding for Jesus' baby sister. I would not be a bit surprised that arrangements had been made for a young woman from Nazareth to marry a young man from Cana, because they are right next door to each other. Jesus would have had a reason for being this wedding, because it's a family wedding. And that also explains why Mother Mary was there, because it's a family wedding. James and John, because they would have been cousins, could have very easily have been invited to this wedding. You remember that we were talking about Nathanael being from this city of Cana, and so he may have been related to perhaps the groom, or at the very least, he certainly would have known the family, because Cana was not a monster-sized city either. So Jesus was not here spur of the moment. He's here on purpose. Then, verse 3, when the wine ran out. Now, weddings back at this time, even amongst people that were not, you know, super wealthy, they still ran several days, maybe a week. Now, that's not like constantly everybody's at the house where the wedding took place, but rather each night everybody would gather back together again for another meal to celebrate the couple. And so lots of wine is served during these several nights together, and that all needs to have been purchased and put in place ahead of time. And unfortunately, they didn't buy enough. And so when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Now, this is another indicator to me that Mary is intimately connected to the wedding itself. Because it'd be one thing if just somebody known to her family had run out of wine. That would be a shame and embarrassment. But the fact that, if I'm correct, one of her daughter's wedding is about to be spoiled because the family of the groom didn't make sure there was enough wine around, that's reason enough for her to tell her oldest boy, "You need to do something about this." There also might be an indication here that Joseph is now deceased, perhaps recently. And so Mary was perhaps asking Jesus to act in the place of the head of the household of the bride. And so that's my speculation, understand, but it makes everything flow very well in what happens next. So Jesus said back to her, "Woman, what does that have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." So what did Mary expect Jesus to do? We were talking about this event just recently in a Sunday school class, and the question came up, was Mary expecting him to do a miracle? And I'm not so sure that she did. I suppose it's possible, because she does know he's the Messiah, and the Messiah was going to be a powerful person. But we know for a fact that this will be the very first miracle of his life. He has done nothing. And so you've got to reject anything that you may have been told about Jesus doing miracles when he was a little boy. All of that is nonsense. It's fables and myths that had been made up in the years that followed the gospel events. Mary didn't know that Jesus could do miracles, but it's possible that she may have suspected it. I will grant that. But I think the bigger thing is she just simply wanted him to take care of it as the big brother. And Jesus' response was, "I am not supposed to be pushing myself into the limelight at this point." And his mother said to the servants, "You do whatever he tells you." And I picture this in that motherly thing where she basically, after he said, "What's that got to do with me, Mom?" She turns away from him to the servant and say, whatever he tells you to do, you just do it. And then she walks off and basically leaves him in this situation of parental pressure. Take care of it. I will point out, for all of those that have, I think, an overdeveloped honor toward Mary, the Mariology that we see in Roman Catholicism and some groups associated with Roman Catholicism, this is the only time that Mary ever gives a command in all of Scripture. And what is her command? Whatever he, Jesus, says, you do it. And I think that is good advice. Don't be paying so much attention to Mary. Pay attention to the Son. Verse number 6. Now, there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification. Now, the Jewish people were all required by Pharisaic tradition to go through this ritual of hand washing before they ate. It involved taking this cup. Probably it has 2 handles on it because that's what the Jewish people use to this day. And dipping it in and pouring it over one hand and then dipping it in and pouring it over the other hand and maybe even doing this a couple of different times. So that takes a lot of water to do all those water ceremonies for all these people that have come for the wedding. And so you've got 6 stone water jars sitting there with all that water. Each one of them was holding about 20 or 30 gallons each. So that's a whole huge amount of water, which is necessary for all the rituals. So Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. Now that doesn't mean they were totally empty. Jesus just wants them to get them full again. So they filled them up to the brim. And then he said to them, now, draw some of that out and take it to the master of the feast. So these are the people who have either been hired to function as the caterers, if you will, at this feast, or they're volunteers from the community that are doing these things. Maybe they're hired hands working for the family. But their whole job is to serve the wine. And Jesus tells them, you take some of that water that you just filled those jars with over to the master of ceremonies. This would be probably a member of the family or a friend of the groom that just made sure everything flowed properly during the several days of celebration. So he's the one that's supposed to be testing the wine as it's being given out. And wine back in this time, you should keep in mind, it was alcoholic. There's no doubt about that. But it was very often cut with water because of the way that it had been kept. Sometimes it might be a little bit too strong. And so they would add a little bit of water to it. And then you would need to know, you know, the proper taste of the dilution factor. So that's one of the responsibilities of this guy. So when they bring this wine to him, he drinks it, takes a little test of it, and the water has become wine in the process of them carrying it from these water jars to the man. Now, he didn't know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, and they must have been very surprised. The master of the feast called the bridegroom, so he's the guy that got married. And he may have been the one that selected the wines to begin with. And so he said to him, everyone serves the good wine first, and then when the people have drunk freely, the poor wine. Now, the wording here should be understood in this sense. Everyone starts with the expensive wine at the beginning of the feast, as in day one, then, as the days go on, that's when they start serving the cheaper versions of the wine. Because by then, everybody's enjoyed themselves to the full at the beginning of the celebrations. And only those that are kind of the hangers-on to the very end are still around. And they're fine with the less expensive stuff. So the guy says, everybody else does it this way. But you have kept the good wine until now. So in his evaluation, the wine he just tested, the wine he just drank, was top grade. It was the best wine he drunk. And so Jesus had performed this miracle, making the best possible tasting wine. Then John tells us this. This, the first of his signs, and that means this is the first of Jesus' miracles. He's 30-something years old, and now he performs the very first of all the miracles that he does as Messiah. The first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, just a few miles from where he grew up, and he manifested his glory. He made it public. And his disciples believed in him. So those six guys that came up here to the wedding with him, who also knew that the water had been turned into wine by Jesus, they are now very much impressed with this being Messiah. And then verse 12 tells us, after this, that is, after this wedding at Cana, he went down to Capernaum with his brothers and his disciples, and he stayed there for a few days. Now, his disciples all seem to be down from that area, other than Nathanael, who is from Cana, although I suspect that he was working as a fisherman or in some fashion over by the Capernaum, Bethsaida area, because he's a close friend of Philip. Now, we know that James and John are from that area, and Peter and Andrew are from that area, which means that Jesus has family there. James and John are his cousins, which means his aunt Salome and his uncle Zebedee live there. And it appears as if this is the time in which Mary moves from Nazareth to Capernaum. And so this is, again, one of my suggestions. It's not gospel-inspired, but it is my suggestion that Joseph had recently passed away and that maybe Mary had been encouraged by the rest of her family, who were adults now. Maybe it was her last daughter that just got married. Maybe now that she's the only person living at home in Nazareth, it was time for her to move closer to her sister Salome and her brother-in-law Zebedee and the nephews and the rest of the family that might have also moved over to Capernaum area. Because Capernaum was a major city on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. And so a good place for her to move to. So Jesus goes there and stays there for a few days. Now the next event is a Passover, which takes place in April of 30. So that is, again, another reason why more than likely the things we've been looking at here recently were all taking place in March of 30, in the last days of the previous Jewish year. Verse number 13. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now all adult males in good health and capability were expected to travel from anywhere inside the confines of the ancient Promised Land to Jerusalem 3 times a year. They were to go there for Feast of Passover in the spring, which is the one we're talking about here. They were to come back again 7 weeks later for at least part of the week that Pentecost fell toward or during. And then they were to come back in the fall of the year for a week called the Feast of Tabernacles. So every year, three times a year, a huge number of the Jewish people were going to Jerusalem for these festivals. And so Jerusalem was just chock-a-block with people. Estimates say that Jerusalem's swelled up to almost 1 million people whenever these feasts were going on. And so the Temple Mount that had been built by Herod just shortly before Jesus' birth, it was just jam-packed with people. It could probably hold, you know, a 250,000 people at one time in all those courts. So Jesus is part of the pilgrim crew that makes its way from Capernaum, from Galilee, on that three-day trip down to Jerusalem a few days before Passover begins so that they can make sure that they are all ceremonially clean by the time Passover begins. And by the way, it always says that you go up to Jerusalem because Jerusalem is the metaphorical high point of Jewish life. Now, verse 14, in the temple, not in the shrine area, but in the complex that surrounded it, the court of the Gentiles, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and money changers sitting there. Now, these guys are, they're part of an effort that was originally intended to be convenience. The scripture said that when you took your tithe, for example, to the place that God has established as the place of worship, if it's too much of an effort to carry all of that material with you, you can change it into money, take that with you, and then buy whatever you need for the feast. That was one of the mechanisms of worship. So for a lot of people, it made good sense to just simply go to the temple and buy your Passover lamb and whatever other sacrifices you needed there rather than take it all the way from Galilee. And also, money changers were there because the money that circulated all over the lower Middle East typically had images on them. And the Jewish people of this time period traditionally thought that images were absolutely wrong. You couldn't have like the head of Caesar on a coin that you gave as a gift to God at the temple. It had to be changed for a different coin that didn't have those images on it. So all of these things were provided to begin with as convenience. But we have discovered through other historical documents that they had been turned into ways to fleece the sheep. So sacrificial grade animals were a lot more expensive to buy at Jerusalem's temple markets. And money changers always attached a fee for changing the money. And this was very upsetting to Jesus, as it would have been to a lot of the religious people of his day. And it's upsetting to us today when we see people using religion to make money off of religious people. And so making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. He wasn't using the whips on the people. He was using it to guide the sheep and oxen out of the temple complex. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. So he's not stealing this stuff from them. He's just simply telling them, you are shut down. you're not going to be doing this business anymore. And he told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away. Don't make my father's house a house of trade. Now, this is the first time he cleanses the temple at the beginning of his ministry in 30. He will do it again in 33 at Passover. And there he will accuse them of turning the temple into a den of thieves. So that's the point, is that they are fleecing the flock, and he is not going to put up with that. And so his disciples remembered that it was written, quote, "Zeal for your house will consume me." That's from Psalm 69:9, and it was thought that that was a reference to the Messiah. So those that are already following him, those six guys, are like, wow, this is amazing. Now, the leadership in the temple were not so impressed. The Jews said to him, "What sign do you show us for doing these things? Who do you think you are? How are you authoritative?" And so Jesus' response was, "Destroy this temple in 3 days, I will raise it up." This is the very first recorded prediction of the resurrection. The Jews then said, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple." Actually, it's literally 46 years this temple has been built, meaning it's been 46 years since it was finished. That helps us place the date as being Passover of 30. "And you're going to raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking about the temple of his body. So they immediately thought that he was being goofy, thinking that he could replace a temple as magnificent as Herod's reconstruction in a matter of 3 days. But he was talking about his resurrection. And so verse 22, "When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he said this, and they believed the scriptures and the word that Jesus had spoken." The resurrection of the dead is the ultimate sign of the Messiah.